Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gab Fest. For July 28th, 2022, it's the Did You Apologize to Manchin Yet edition. I'm David Plotz of CityCast. I'm here in Washington, D.C. I'm joined by John Dickerson of CBS News in New York. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And back from travels hither and yon, everywhere and nowhere, to the back of beyond, Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School, who's back in New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Hello. Since I was out of the country, I felt like an expat using the GabFest to stay abreast of America while I was away. And it worked really well.
Wow. That's interesting. You use the GabFest to stay abreast while you're... I do not use it when I'm traveling.
I thought it was great. Well, you should listen when you're not on the show. It's a good thing to do. You kind of, you know, learn something.
This week, will Joe Manchin's agreement with Democrats save the party, rescue the Biden presidency, and usher in 1,000 years of peace and prosperity? Then the January 6th investigation at the Justice Department seems to be closing in on Trump. Could the former president be prosecuted? What stands in the way? Then the most dangerous road for pedestrians in the United States is a stretch of U.S. 19 on the Gulf Coast of Florida. We're going to talk to Maren Kogan of Vox, who visited that stretch of road, about her fascinating piece about why it's so dangerous and whether it can be fixed. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. ArmorAll, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Comes news late on Wednesday that Build Back Better is dead, but long live Build Back Better or Build Back Smaller or the Inflation Reduction Act. John, Joe Manchin says he and the Democrats, by which I guess he means Chuck Schumer, President Biden, presumably Nancy Pelosi, have an agreement on a reconciliation bill that can be passed with 50 votes that would do what?
So what's in the bill is $433 billion worth of spending, which is has some important provisions. The healthcare ones are that 13 million Americans will see their subsidies they get for the Affordable Care Act. Those won't increase. So that will continue for the next 3 years. There will also be some changes in the way Medicare handles drug prices. They will now be able to negotiate for cheaper drug prices as a part of Medicare, which is huge. And it also caps out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs at $2,000. So those are two really important healthcare elements of the provision. The $370 billion in climate change and clean energy production includes... which would be, I think, the largest piece of legislation related to climate change ever. It basically provides billions of dollars in rebates to make your home greener, tax credits and investment tax credits for companies that get greener or make stuff that makes the world greener. You get some tax credits if you buy solar panels, batteries, technology that... discourages emissions. There's also relief in there for people who buy electric vehicles. Oh, and it's other important thing is there's $300 billion in deficit reduction, which is why it has this amusingly euphemistic name. And that mostly comes from two things, a minimum tax for corporations of 15% and a tightening of the carried interest loophole, not a closure, which is a lot of coverage has called it, closing the carried interest loophole. That essentially allows investment managers to have their salary taxed as capital gains instead of income, which means it can be taxed at 20% instead of 37%. It's been this weird thing that's lived on, even though Trump wanted to get rid of it. And anyway, it's now under threat again. And that's where they get some of this revenue, which is what allows Manchin to call it an inflation bill because it will reduce the deficit.
When you look at the hurdles in front of it, what are the hurdles? So we have a deal on paper, but you know the ducks will start to nibble at the carried interest. The corporations will start to nibble at the corporate tax, Republicans will start to nibble at Kristen Sinema. What are the possible obstacles to this becoming an actual law?
Some of the obstacles include Sinema, who, if she says no to some provision, I mean, in theory, could tank the whole bill, or it will unwind something that Manchin wouldn't like, and you'd have to go back to the drawing board. So that's one thing that could. The parliamentarian, because this is passing through reconciliation, it has to meet the budget requirements that were put in place in order to sort of force Senate to maintain deficit reduction. There's COVID among the Democratic senators, and you need all 50 of them to be there. I think then there's some cross branch issues, which is that I guess there's some possibility progressives in the House would balk. I don't think so in the end. They'll balk, but is it the end going to threaten it? I probably don't think so. And there's some connective tissue to this semiconductor bill that passed the Senate that Republicans in the House, now that they've seen that this reconciliation package might go through, are all going to vote against the semiconductor legislation, which means Pelosi will have to pass it with all Democratic votes, which means she's got a thin margin. If she loses some Democrats on that, she might not be able to pass this important priority for the president. I think that probably gets worked out too. But there's a lot of sort of management of the liberals that Pelosi's going to have to do to make this go forward.
Emily, with this prospective legislation, with the prospective passage of the CHIPS Act, with a prospective possibility of a protection of marriage equality, this would be a bunch of medium-sized wins for Democrats. How helpful do you think this stuff might be for Democrats politically come November, given that there is still all this economic bad news, given that the same day as Manchin's announcement, the Fed raised interest rates another 0.75, and that we're probably on the verge of a recession?
I would say necessary, but not sufficient. I mean, I think it's just crucial for the Democrats to be able to say that they accomplished some things, that there's a reason to keep them in power. They have these, really, I think, more than medium-sized accomplishments to point to. I mean, this is the largest climate change bill we've had in the country. Our country has obviously played this leading role in carbon emissions. So it's our responsibility to address it. I actually think it's totally gimmicky, but smart to call it the Inflation Reduction Act.
Yes, agreed.
And, you know, the semiconductor bill, the fact that it's bipartisan is a kind of win for Democrats on its own, because it shows that actually, like, this dream of the parties working together, which, you know, sometimes, I mean, certainly Biden talked about it during the campaign, is actually possible to accomplish, at least in this particular area of industrial policy. It would be amazing if there would be protections for same-sex marriage in federal law in a way that this very conservative Supreme Court presumably will not be able to touch. So I think that's like some real important developments on fronts that are popular, that voters care about. Now, are they going to take care of people's concerns about inflation and a looming recession? I don't think so. Maybe they're enough to make the difference in a few really close elections, and maybe they'll put Biden or whoever runs for president, having listened to your segment suggesting that he won't or shouldn't be the candidate in 2024, although I realize that's a long way away. How close is this deal to what Manchin wanted, nine and more months ago?
Well, I think some people would answer, nobody ever knew what Manchin wanted. It is.
Well, there's that like scribble down on a napkin deal with Schumer thing.
Right. This isn't that. I think the operative question is, how close is it to what Schumer wanted? I mean, so it doesn't include, you know, any of the family medical leave, elder care, child care, any of the original stuff in Build Back Better. But it does include the taxes, the tax piece, which was weird because Manchin was always on board with a tax. He was fine with, you know, quote unquote, taxing the rich. We talked about this a couple weeks ago on the show. It made his comments about inflation weird, because if you're taxing the rich, presumably you're reducing the deficit. And as a result of doing that, you are affecting inflation. So you can't use inflation as a reason not to vote for something that taxes the rich. So that was inconsistent. So I think in the end, when we look at the energy provisions, there's some stuff about making it more costly to emit methane and other things. And I don't know how much some very smart person on, you know, the environment will know what kind of carve-outs and things were done that don't affect West Virginia that we can then say, okay, we see this was authored in a way to protect Manchin. I mean, obviously that pipeline he wants to go through West Virginia is something that promotes the production of gas. So that's one thing he wanted, but that's not in the bill. So I guess, Emily, the short answer to your question is the deficit reduction that's in it. Oh, there's one other aspect to deficit reduction in addition to the carried interest loophole and the minimum tax is that the IRS gets more money to go after tax cheats. So that's all stuff to make the inflation picture a little brighter.
John, closing on this, you were talking a few minutes ago about the potential obstacles. Can you just talk about two things quickly? One, how rapidly could the Democrats move on this if they're able to move? That's number one. And number two, what kind of payback do you think Republicans will seek to exact for getting beaten if they end up getting beaten?
Assuming they get Sinema on board with this, and I don't think there's really any other major hurdle. They can get it done by next week. Republicans, as of Thursday morning, there was reporting that Republicans are bailing on burn pit legislation. So the burn pit legislation, was a massively bipartisan legislation to help basically veterans who were exposed to harmful and destructive chemicals as a result of working near burn pits, being exposed to Agent Orange. That was passed, and they had to tweak something in the legislation just from a technical matter. And now there's some indication on Thursday morning that Republicans are withholding their vote because of this. They're basically doing on burn pits what McConnell had pledged to do on the semiconductor chips legislation, which is not vote for it as penalty, David, for this reconciliation bill. That seems to be the way things, what I read Thursday morning, but, I worry that this will shift over time, but that's that. And they will come up with other ways to try to punish, Democrats for doing this. But on the other hand, in his quiet moments, Mitch McConnell probably recognizes some of his own legislative skill in this, if this is what happens.
Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments on the GabFest and on other Slate podcasts. Of course, you can become a member by going to slate.com/GabFestPlus. We have a great bonus segment today. It's going to be a Bazelon special, always the best kind. We're going to talk about the proposed reforms to the Electoral Count Act, and we're going to dig deep on what might happen. Another Joe Manchin legislative activity. He's had a very busy summer, that Joe Manchin. If you want to become a member, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus. You will also, of course, get member-exclusive episodes from other shows, and you'll get no ads on any Slate podcasts and unlimited reading on the Slate site, slate.com/GabFestPlus. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
The January 6th committee has taken a summer hiatus. It has been renewed for a second season in September, but there is plenty of new content for fans and stands. Notably, this week came news that Department of Justice is clearly nosing around President Trump for potential crimes. There are leaks seemingly from lawyers or from clients who were talking to grand juries, indicating that DOJ prosecutors are very curious about what President Trump's role was in various parts of this scheme to overturn the election results. And also, and let's start with this, the remarkable New York Times story, Emily, about the again, to use the word scheme, the scheme to create fake electors, these fake electors who could be a pretext for overturning the election. In one of those don't put the conspiracy in writing guys situations.
Don't use emojis, at least.
The people coming up with the scheme literally called them fake electors.
And then we're like, oh, maybe we should call them alternate electors. Ha ha ha. Emoji wink.
What was the scheme? Why is the news about it important? What was the potential, what's revelatory about that?
I mean, this is a group of lawyers. They weren't within the administration, but they were clearly channeling to Rudy Giuliani and to Mark Meadows. And they were doing exactly what you said, talking about how to get fake electors together. At one point, they mentioned the problem that because of COVID, their fake electors wouldn't be able to meet in the Michigan State House, which was a requirement under Michigan law. I mean, they were really getting into the kind of nitty gritty here of how to do this. And I don't know. You read these emails and you think, do these people appreciate at all that we have a democracy? And they were talking about substituting people who were not elected in place of the people who were elected so that they could reverse the will of the people and report the wrong election results. It's almost like they were kind of giddy with the scheming. And also, I just got the sense that, you know, this is just sort of a part of Trump world in which you're in your bubble and any kind of ends justify the means. And you just like forget all about things like democracy and rule of law.
That's the most pernicious part of what's behind these hearings is the fact that for a lot of people, the rioters didn't go far enough, that that Democrats have been described and continue to be described in such apocalyptic terms, and all of the ruin that they are taking to American life, that basically all bets are off.
There are these stories, people are pointing out that one of the prerequisites for all this scheming and all this manipulation is the Electoral College. So without the Electoral College, none of this would really matter very much. The popular vote is just much harder to manipulate in a country like the U.S. And the fact that we have these electors, this sort of intermediary stage between the voters and the election, makes mischief possible in ways that it's not really possible in countries that have popular election. They have different forms of mischief in those countries, but all the ones that the Trump folks have come up with were premised on sorts of legal chicanery and manipulation of this middle stage of the process.
And the middle stage of the process that's no longer bears any resemblance to its original design, which was hysterically, when Hamilton was selling the Constitution, he said it's the Electoral College that will ensure we have virtuous leaders because it's got this really cool function. All the electors will be virtuous and care about the proper constitution of a chief executive. And they will put their extraordinary brain power towards picking the person who is most qualified, including this, had this important thing called virtue as a part of their character. And that was the reason to vote for the Constitution. He argued the Electoral College was the single thing that guaranteed that this was going to bring virtuous presidents.
Couldn't you have the Electoral College? I mean, I hate the Electoral College, but couldn't you have it without the electors? You could just have, like, you certify the vote, this whole separate stage. It just creates this clunky machinery.
No, but the problem is that you have within each state this potential, you have 50 points of manipulation to manipulate the result in any close individual state. And you have the state government with the capacity to interfere. Whereas if you just say it's like the total amount in the country, the 5 or 10,000 votes that differ, you have a difference of in Pennsylvania, don't make a difference.
This amusing fake electors foolishness is proof of how hard it is to actually conspire. That the Trump fantasy about a stolen election requires, and we've said it before, but the bears requires extraordinary collaboration among people who never said a peep and still haven't said a peep about this coordinated effort to steal the election. Whereas the Trump coordinated effort to try to steal the election has had thousands of mistakes and bungles and which is the nature of human behavior. And so in the shambolic way in which the deadly serious, but shambolic way in which the Trump effort tried to overthrow the election went by, it reminds you that, you know, quiet conspiracies are really hard to pull off.
Good point. Emily, so let's turn to this question of the potential investigation into Trump by the Department of Justice. What did you make of the stories that grand juries are questioning witnesses, including Mike Pence associates, about Trump and his involvement? And what I have absolutely lost track of all the potential crimes he could be charged with. So remind us what the potential crimes are.
Well, I mean, that it is a list. I mean, so first of all, I think these stories are pretty significant. They seem to be sourced from, you know, witnesses or defense lawyers. Now I'm channeling our friend Ben Wittes, who wrote a smart Twitter thread about this. And the big question looming over the Justice Department has been whether they are willing and interested and able to reach Trump's role in a variety of ways, to answer your second question. And it seems from these reports that the answer is yes. I mean, that's very different from actually investigating the president directly. It's far different from an indictment. But they're not leaving that out of the picture, right? I mean, it seems like when the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, said the other day that nobody is above the rule of law, and then a reporter said, does that include Trump? And he got slightly testy and basically said, I'm just going to repeat what I just said. It seems like, at least if we believe these reports, there's some evidence for that, which of course is exactly as it should be, because it is super important for the president, for any president, not to be above the rule of law. In terms of various crimes, I mean, there's this very interesting investigation going on in Georgia about Trump's call to Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, you know, looking for non-existent votes to overturn that election. That is a very good fit with state law about, you know, the crime of interfering with an election. Then there are the events on January 6th and leading up to January 6th. I mean, maybe the hardest count would be some kind of, like, you know, criminal incitement count for the speech that Trump gave before January 6th. That has lots of First Amendment protections in it. But then there's just interfering with Congress trying to certify the election, obstructing a congressional proceeding. And then there's this broader idea of defrauding the United States, which could be kind of more of a grab bag of various kinds of conduct. And I'm sure there are things I'm leaving out as I catalog this, because there are just a lot of different fingers of this probe that's going on.
Right. I mean, it's clear that it is, if he did what he's accused of, it's utterly treasonous behavior towards the Constitution of the United States. And yet it's also kind of hard to say. It's not like a homicide. It's not like, oh yes, he's murdered this person in this way. It's a set of behaviors which, taken together, are clearly designed to subvert the election and go against the will of the people, and to end run the Constitution in some ways. And so that ought to be a crime, but yet figuring out what the crime is seems tricky. That's why you need impeachment.
I mean, I think there are various statutes that this would fit under. And, you know, we've been talking for months about criminal intent, and can prosecutors prove that Trump knew he was setting out to prevent Congress from certifying the election, overturn the results, etc. I mean, I feel like the January 6th committee has been kind of genius at showing that there's every reason to think that he probably did have criminal intent. And then there's also, you know, the very well-documented events after the rioting started, in which he had this legal duty to try to stop what was going on, and he did not. And we know about the entreaties he was receiving from people around him, including Ivanka Trump. Like, that's, you know, that seems, stuff seems pretty solid and pretty indicative of his state of mind.
I have two thoughts. One is one from David French, which is that if there isn't a prosecution, that basically what you end up doing is deciding that presidents are held to a lower standard of criminal behavior than almost any other American citizen. That results from this, if you don't, if something more doesn't happen. And then in terms of what's happening in the committee hearings, I thought what was most striking about the last Thursday's testimony was it wasn't so much what White House officials testified to, which was basically Donald Trump doing nothing, fulfilling none of his obligations, and in fact working to pour gasoline on the fire. It was that what he wasn't doing that is so important. And the reason that's interesting to me is that none of his defenders on every other point can say, oh, well, you know, he wasn't inciting the crowd. He told them to go peacefully, which is not a serious argument, but it is nevertheless something you can offer. The absolute inability to offer a single thing that he did once he knew that the rioting was taking place. Nobody can come forward with anything he did, not one thin fibrillation to stop the or even care. And he was getting people calling him on the phone saying, help us. We're in the building. They're attacking. Help us. And he did nothing.
And he was refusing. And Meadows was saying the president's not interested in this.
The Pentagon called, and his lawyer had to take the call because he didn't want to talk to the Pentagon. Mike Pence had to.
And the vice president was on the phone, which is like totally not how the constitutional line of chain of command is supposed to be working.
And so it changes the directional defense of the president. You know, you can distract. But the fact that nobody will defend him by saying, oh, no, he was doing this. The closest they can do is say 3 days before he mumbled something to Nancy Pelosi about the National Guard, of which there is no record. And the acting Secretary of Defense says, no, there was no order under oath. Under oath, he said this. He didn't say this on Sean Hannity. He said something else. But under oath, he said there was no order from the president. But the best defense they can make is that 3 days before the rioting started, he might have said something about the National Guard. Again, there's no evidence of that. But if you're a fire chief, and the best you can say is 3 days before the fire went up that you were standing in front of, you mumbled something about hoses, is not a super strong defense.
Don't forget that he threw his lunch at the wall. That was really important.
Every month, we are doing a new episode, an additional new episode for your feed called Gabfest Reads, where one of us reads a book from an author we admire, a new book that's coming out. And our Gabfest Reads for July just dropped in your feed a few days ago. It's Emily interviewing Vanessa Waugh about Waugh's book, Forbidden City. Emily, how did that go? Why should our listeners listen?
First of all, Vanessa is very thoughtful about her work. I love talking to her. But also, this is one of those just like fascinating reimaginings of history. This book is about a young woman who is kind of brought to Chairman Mao and her efforts to become independent and kind of fight for her own destiny, even though, you know, she's basically like being used as a paramour, first as a dancer. And she just has to figure out how to kind of make her way in kind of cultural, pre-cultural and then cultural revolution China. It's a terrific summer read. And Vanessa has lots of things to say about the research she did for her book and her thinking about why she decided to choose this character, to create this character.
Check it out in Gabfest Reads.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
I cannot decide if the words or the pictures in Maren Kogan's amazing news stories for Vox are more gripping and terrifying. The Deadliest Road in America is Maren's story of a stretch of US 19, a road along the Florida Gulf Coast that has the dismal distinction of being the most dangerous place to be a pedestrian in the United States. Maren's story details the confluence of circumstances, bad design, ambiguous purpose, demographics, that make it a hellscape for pedestrians. And the photos of the road, these eight lanes of traffic punctuated very occasionally by a stoplight, are scarier than even a Jordan Peele movie looks to be. Maren, welcome to the Gabfest. Can you start by describing US 19 to us, and then start by telling us the numbers. How dangerous is it, and why is it so dangerous?
Yeah, so US 19 looks like a lot of roads all across the US. It is multiple lanes going each direction with turn lanes on either side. So at many intersections, you're looking at 8 or 9 lanes. The speed limits are 45 to 55 miles an hour. And there are commercial businesses pretty much lining this entire road. So essentially what you have is a highway with lots of commercial development on either side, lots of cars turning, lots of cars moving at very high speeds. And then also you have lots of people who need to walk the road. But because the road is so unfriendly to pedestrians, sometimes the crosswalks are a mile or more apart. So what you often see is people, you know, if they're trying to get across the street to a business on the other side, they might have to walk a mile or more to cross safely. And so it creates this really dangerous conditions for pedestrians trying to navigate the space. And, you know, in terms of deadliness, pedestrian fatalities are on the rise in this country, and this is something that I've sort of been watching happen over the last few years. It really took off during the pandemic. And last year, there was a really interesting study published by some researchers who took all of the government's data on pedestrian fatalities from 2000 to 2016, and they tried to identify hotspots. So these are 1,000-meter stretches of road where 6 or more people have died over 2 different 8-year periods. And they identified 60 of the hotspots across the country. They're in New York, they're in LA, they're in Albuquerque, New Mexico, they're everywhere, they're in Georgia. But 7 of those hotspots were in this single stretch of road in this single county. It was really striking, even to the researchers who expected to find some overlap. So this is just a truly very deadly road and a very deadly place for pedestrians.
I love this term of strode. That you used, which I think really gets at the idea that the roads were created for one thing, even though all these businesses have appeared and turned them into something else. And it's that failed conflict of dual functionality that's at the heart of this problem. Anyway, explain what a strode is.
Yeah, I love the term strode too. And I think if this piece does nothing else but introduce people to that concept, it will have been successful. So
I totally dropped that at a party last night. I talked to people about strodes all party long. So it's spreading.
Yeah, good. Yeah. So one of my editors said that the term strode has become an intrusive thought for her. Like, she can't stop thinking about it because it is. You will see these in your community. Like, you know, any listener, if they want to go out and look, they will find these strodes in their community. So strode is a term coined by this guy, Chuck Marone, who was a professional traffic engineer for many years and has since become a critic of his profession. And he says, if you think of a road, a road is designed to get people from point A to point B at a high speed. So a road, you want to have cars moving quickly and efficiently through the space. They tend to be wide open, multi-lane. If you think of a freeway is a good example of a road. You're just trying to get from point A to point B as efficiently as possible. And so you have all the traffic moving in one direction. It's high speed, it's efficient, and it's clear on either side so that if there is a driver error, they're not going to crash into a person, a tree, a business, something else. Now, a street is a place. A street is not just about getting from point A to point B. A street is a place. If you think about, we all have these in our communities. It's a place where people live, they shop, they dine, they play, they commune. And on a street, you really want to have the traffic be very slow so that pedestrians can access the space safely. And so that the people driving through aren't just plowing through, they're interacting with the community around them. A strode is trying to do both things. And it's doing neither of them well. So it's multi-lanes, high speed, lots of traffic and congestion, lots of businesses on either side that pedestrians need to access. And so what you're doing is you're creating infinite possibilities for conflict between cars and between cars and people. And that is one thing that I think I really want people to take away from this, because some people are like, well, it's just Florida, you know, Florida. It's actually not Florida. This is a national issue. And, you know, the second deadliest hotspot on this study that I looked at is in Maryland. So these things are all over. You will see them everywhere.
Where in Maryland?
Langley Park. It's suburban DC, essentially. So and you guys have seen these things in our community. They're everywhere.
Two questions. One, Florida, right? So does that add anything at all? And then the second thing is the fact that we're more dangerous. Driving is more dangerous. Cars are bigger. People are more reckless. And particularly during COVID, how much of it is that is affected by that, the fact that we're just more dangerous drivers?
There's something special about Florida, I think, although Florida is also at the same time representative. One of the experts I spoke to about this said is the way to think about Florida is as a leading edge of a lot of national trends. Because there's so much growth and development, so many people are moving to Florida. And because a lot of that development is more recent, you know, in the last 50, 60 years, you tend to see trends happen there faster than they do in the rest of the country. But certainly what is going on in Florida is matched by what's going on nationally. So pedestrian fatalities were on the rise for the last decade already. And then the pandemic, you know, really sort of made the pedestrian fatality soar. Like once the pandemic started, we started seeing really alarming numbers of pedestrian fatalities. And last year, I think it was something like 7,400 pedestrians were killed on US streets and roads. And that's the highest number in 40 years. So, you know, this idea that it's people driving more recklessly, I have heard that. I think, you know, my anecdotal, you know, observations seem to suggest that something is going on. But the most compelling theory from experts I talked to, and the one I think is correct, is that actually what happened with the pandemic is it disrupted the normal traffic patterns. It brought down a lot of the peak time congestion. And so congestion, we all think of congestion as an awful thing. It's very annoying. But actually, congestion was one of the best traffic calming measures that we have. So what happened was when you disrupted all of these peak commuting times, it made the roads much more open. And the roads are designed in a way to signal to drivers, like, drive really fast. And the best thing preventing you from driving really fast and killing someone is when you have a bunch of cars in front of you, right? So removing that congestion actually just exposed the dangerous designs that we already had. And I also want to add, I don't think it's just the design issue. It is the design issue. It's also the fact that trucks and SUVs have become a much larger share of the market in the last 20 years, and they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's a simple fact that those bigger vehicles are much deadlier to people outside vehicles than smaller cars and sedans are.
Maren, this is definitely not an unfixable problem. There are ways to make US 19 safer and roads like US 19. So what are those ways?
So there are a couple different theories about what would be the best thing to do. If you talk to someone like Chuck Marone, who came up with this concept of a strode, his theory is that we basically need to deprogram them. So rather than having traffic engineers decide what a road should look like, and they're doing it based on these standards that have sort of always treated car as king, you should actually have local officials deciding what a given street is going to be. So if we want this to be a street, we need to narrow the lanes, we need to slow down traffic, we need to do a bunch of traffic calming measures, and we need to make it much, much safer for pedestrians. Chuck would say the flip side of that is if we decide that it should be a road, we need to cut off all these access points to all the commercial businesses. It's sprawl. We're talking about sprawl, right? Sprawl is incredibly deadly and hostile to people who aren't in cars. It almost necessitates that you drive. So he's like, all right, if this is going to be a road, we want it to get people from point A to point B. Don't make it a place where everyone is turning every 500 feet. And don't make it like a place where we're expecting people to walk. Come up with other avenues for people to walk. The people who work in the sort of safety advocacy space would say basically that you need to go the other direction. Like there's no reason why we need 9 lanes on US 19. And that was something I noticed is like several times when I was driving and it wasn't peak traffic, the road was wide open. And it was really interesting to drive the road and then walk the road. So I would drive the road and I would sort of take notes on my recorder about what I was seeing and doing. And it's soothing and sort of, it's just a wide open road, you know, and it's almost hard not to go fast because it's just designed for you to go fast. And then I walked the road to dinner one night and I was, you know, cursing myself the whole time because it was hot and horrible and really difficult to cross and just totally unfriendly. Like, you don't notice necessarily the danger if you're a driver, and that's how most people are accessing that space. But if you're forced to access it as a pedestrian, which many people are and many people have to, it becomes very obvious that this road was not made for you.
It seems like the pedestrians are outweighed here by two powerful forces. One is all the businesses that want cars to have easy access zooming in and out of their parking lots. And the second is all the people zooming in their cars who want to keep zooming in their cars. Is that imbalance always going to put the pedestrian on the wrong side of this? Or is there some way that pedestrians can win at either the local or the larger level?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I think pedestrians certainly are and have been the underdog in this fight. And it's sort of ironic to talk about it as pedestrians versus drivers, because most of us are both, right? But it is true that, I mean, this system is designed with cars in mind. And it is an unfortunate reality that, you know, the people who tend to be walking are often not walking because, like, this is fun. I love walking on the side of a highway. They're walking because they don't have other options. Either they're unable to drive, they don't have a license, and they're, you know, they tend to be lower income. So a lot of these strodes identified in the study border low-income neighborhoods. Certainly in Pasco County, there's a large population of low-income and people experiencing homelessness, and that creates a lot more people on the road. And those people have less political power than, you know, the car lobby and everyone who, you know, drives and doesn't really think about driving as like a privilege or think about the way that their driving might be contributing to some things that are socially harmful. So I do think that that is a big issue. The flip side of it is I do think that there has been a growing movement and a growing infrastructure of people pushing back on the status quo and saying that we really do need to think more about pedestrian and cyclist safety, and that, you know, the number of people dying on our streets is not safe, it's not healthy, it's not normal, and that change is possible. I mean, I think about this a lot with Ralph Nader and Unsafe at Any Speed. I mean, lots more people were dying in car crashes before this sort of driver safety and automotive safety movement got started, and seatbelts and other safety improvements worked. You know, a lot less people are dying in car crashes now than they were before. Like, it's possible to make these improvements for pedestrians too. We just need to recognize that it's a problem and start valuing people who are not inside cars.
Maren Kogan's article, "The Deadliest Road in America," is in Vox. It is just your conversation starter for the month. Maren, thanks for coming on the GabFest.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let us go to cocktail chatter. Emily, what are you going to chatter about?
I'm going to double chatter since I was out. If there is a GabFest listener who has not yet listened to or watched Joni Mitchell sing,
that was going to be my double chatter too. Good, my second one. Bring it. Yeah.
We are predictable. You just have to watch that video. It is really just amazing. And I salute Brandi Carlile, the singer who's been, I think, doing a lot to kind of continue Mitchell's legacy, for just striking exactly the right balance between singing along and mostly just giving the spotlight to Joni Mitchell. And, you know, to see someone who is older, who has had health issues, whose voice has really changed in its timbre, perform after, I think, 9 years with such vigor and obviously pleasure. I just thought it was an amazing tribute to stardom and to aging and to music. My second chatter is about the Federal Trade Commission and the fact that it took a pretty aggressive step this week against Facebook. Facebook is trying to conquer the virtual reality market and was trying to buy a VR developer called Within, which makes some fitness app that Facebook was after. And the FTC is saying not so fast. And in some ways, this is kind of strange because it's a relatively small company in terms of value. On the other hand, what you clearly see here is that Lina Khan, who's at the FTC and is incredibly smart about the problems of monopoly and trying to prevent monopoly, remembers that letting Facebook buy WhatsApp and Instagram was a real mistake in terms of creating hugely concentrated force in the marketplace for one company over not just its own business, but related businesses. And so what you see here is the FTC kind of taking a proactive step to try to prevent that from happening. It'll be really interesting to see where this goes.
John Dickerson, what is your chatter?
My chatter is about the most wide-ranging study of its kind. 40 scientists helped gather and analyze 1,600 voice recordings from 410 parents in six continents, 18 languages from diverse communities of all different kinds, and they found that the most common language that connects all of us is Parentese, which some of you may already know. This is not the first time this has ever been studied, but this is, I think, the widest ranging. That basically baby talk connects. We all talk to babies essentially in the same way. And the way they tested this was by creating a game called Who's Listening that you could play online. 50,000 people spoke in 199 languages from 187 countries, and participants were asked to determine whether a song or a passage of speech was being addressed to a baby or an adult. And the researchers found that basically listeners were able to tell that about 70%, with 70% accuracy when the sounds were aimed at babies than when they were, you know, not aimed at babies. So I just like the idea that there is some basic way in which all humans are connected. So anyway, I just like that in this time of division and strife and the feeling that we're all tied merely by fraying threads to the human community. If we all just talked like babies and behaved like babies, we'd all be fine.
And my chatter is about puppy whoppies. I am chattering about the story which has fixated me, which has obsessed me, mostly because my girlfriend is completely obsessed with it. So there's this incredible story. There's an animal testing facility or a facility which raised animals for pharmaceutical testing in Cumberland, Maryland, and they raised beagles. Cumberland, Virginia, excuse me. And they raised beagles. And because of a series of investigations by various authorities, a judge determined that this was an unsanitary, unsafe, inhumane facility. And 4,000 beagles have been rescued from this facility, and they are now being distributed to animal welfare organizations around the country, a lot of them in the D.C. area because it's relatively near D.C. And so there are thousands of adult beagles and hundreds of beagle puppies that are now seeking homes. And they're just gazillions of applicants, including my girlfriend, for these dogs to have a new home. And it's just like the social media videos of these puppies and dogs are unbelievably charming and heartrending. They've all been tattooed on the ear. They all have these number tattoos on their ears because they were being raised for research purposes. And it's just really a sad story, a happy story, because they've all been rescued from what seems to have been a pretty unpleasant life. Ambiguous, ambivalent story, because of course we do need to test pharmaceuticals. They have to be tested, and they use beagles because I guess beagles are docile and small, and that is sad that they're used. It's also good that we get medicines out of it, so it's a complicated issue, but of course you would want your beagle raised humanely. Anyway, I strongly recommend checking out these social media feeds and looking at the beautiful beagles and this fascinating story of their rescue. And if you have a line on a beagle puppy from the Invigo Beagles that you would like to deliver to my girlfriend, let me know, because she would be she loves beagles. She's had beagles. She would be a great carer of a beagle pup. So, you know, let me know about that. Listeners, you sent us chatters as well. You tweet them to us at Slate Gabfest, and you email them to us at gabfest@slate.com. And this week's listener chatter, comes from Mark Allender.
Hello, everybody. This is Mark Allender from Cleveland, Ohio. And I wanted to draw your attention to an episode of the podcast The Dollop about Supreme Court Justice James Clark McReynolds, the worst Supreme Court justice in history. Not only was he backward in the opinions that he wrote, but he was just a miserable human being all around to everybody he knew, to everybody that he came in contact with. For starters, he was Wilson's attorney general, but he was such a miserable person to be around that to get him out of the AG's office, Wilson nominated him to the Supreme Court, where he sat for life.
That's our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Shana Roth. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. It's so nice to have the whole gang back together with Emily back. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations, and Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Audio for Slate. Please follow us on Twitter at Slate Gabfest and tweet your chatter to us there, or email it to us at gabfest@slate.com. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? Joe Manchin, very busy, very, very busy these days. While you've been slacking around, he's been negotiating secretly with everyone he can negotiate with. And he and Susan Collins have a bill to reform the Electoral Count Act. And we're going to talk about it now. This is Emily, what is the problem that this bill seeks to solve, and how would it do it or not do it?
So the problem here is an 1887 law called the Electoral Count Act, which is, it's just a mess. I mean, it's a mess in many of its details, and it creates these opportunities for chicanery in terms of all the steps it takes to certify a presidential election. There's just a lot of monkey business that unprincipled, particularly state officials, could engage in. These questions about, like, whether if there's a failed election, what that even means, what would happen. And then, you know, given the events of January 6th, there's this new concern that it's not completely clear that the vice president's role in certifying the count is purely ministerial, meaning he just, like, sits there and presides and stamps it, and he's not supposed to be exercising his or her discretion in any way. So the question has been, what do you do about all these things? And there are different schools of thought, different ways of fixing it. This Electoral Count Reform Act that Manchin and Collins and others have been working on takes what seems to be, from the sort of law professor reaction, a really good crack at a lot of it. So some of the details, and I'm now cribbing from Bob Bauer and Jack Goldsmith in Lawfare. So the bill gives full effect to state laws that govern presidential elections that are in place on the date of the vote. This is important. This means that you can't have a state legislature decide after the vote, oh, we didn't mean it, now we're going to declare we the legislature instead of we the people who the winner is. It eliminates, to every extent possible, the tools that various state rogue actors have to disregard the results of those elections after the fact. So there are all these duties that are imposed on state officials. There is a clear judicial review process. They got rid of that super unclear language about a failed election. Really,
that was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.